Hillary Clinton was victorious in the battle to capture Pennsylvania voters.
I might stumble and I might get knocked down, but as long as you'll stand with me, I will always get right back up.
Back up she was, beating rival Senator Barack Obama, who spent far more money. The race is still on for the Democratic presidential nomination. Good morning and get ready. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Barack Obama's mind is on the next primary, Indiana. He's in the 812 area code, Evansville.
Now it's up to you, Indiana.
After Pennsylvania, there are three questions for this crazy campaign. Has Obama become George McGovern? Has Clinton become Hubert Humphrey? And is John McCain Richard Nixon? Oh my gosh, it's a 1968 time warp.
And in other headlines today, Jordan's King Abdullah has a private breakfast with President Bush this morning. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will meet with Bush tomorrow in anticipation of Bush's Middle East trip next month, aimed at a final attempt to broker a peace deal before his term is up. President Bush is also talking about the U.S. economy. After 2 days of international trade talks at the North American Leaders Summit in New Orleans, Mr. Bush had this to say.
We're not in a recession. We're in a slowdown. We grew in the fourth quarter last year. We haven't had first quarter growth statistics yet, but there's no question we're in a slowdown.
Certainly lots to debate there. Mr. Bush was speaking after meeting with the Canadian Prime Minister and the Mexican President.
Church leaders in Zimbabwe are appealing for international intervention to help solve their country's drawn-out election process. In a disturbing joint statement, the leaders of Zimbabwe's main churches said people were being abducted, tortured, and murdered in a campaign of political retribution. A government spokesman has dismissed these latest allegations. And in one of the latest never minds from the U.S. government, it's scrapping a $20 million virtual fence along the Arizona-Mexico border. The fence consists of 9 electronic surveillance towers along the border southwest of Tucson. Customs and Border Protection officials acknowledge that the program to detect illegal immigrants doesn't work well enough, that it fails to alert Border Patrol agents to illegal crossings. The problem there, of course, is, you know, virtual immigrants. That's really not a problem.
What did you call it? The never mind category?
What's the never mind? Virtual immigrants are not a problem. It's
I'm
the real
remember that.
Illegal immigrants that are the problem.
In New York, an 84-year-old American citizen faces federal charges. He's accused of spying for the Israeli government by passing on military secrets, including sensitive U.S. nuclear weapon information. Ben Ami Kadish was a former Army mechanical engineer at a New Jersey base in the 1980s.
Well, I hope Israelis are happy with all that security information. You know, who's gonna get out of this mess for the Democrats?
I don't know, but I got one more story about New York City.
Forget it.
I do.
Who cares about New York?
Interesting. Restaurant owners here are fighting real hard to keep those calorie listings off the menus. The New York State Restaurant Association, they want the federal court to step in. Last week, though, a federal judge approved the regulation, saying it might help fight obesity.
This is putting calorie numbers on the menu?
It is.
Yeah, that'll help. Anyway, who's going to help the Democrats?
Howard Dean, perhaps?
Well, if you were Howard Dean, let's make you Howard Dean today. How would you get the party out of this stalemate? Send us your scenarios to superdelegates and party officials to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The question is, would you want to be Howard Dean today?
Hey. Sure. I'll do that. I'll do that job.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
A big night for Senator Hillary Clinton, right? A big win in Pennsylvania.
Tough morning for Barack Obama.
And what did she say, though? She said, quote, the tide is turning in her favor. That's a victorious Clinton beating Barack Obama by just under 10 percentage points last night in Pennsylvania. But it's not over. Two more important Democratic primaries in North Carolina and Indiana are coming up in 2 weeks.
The bipolar Democrats.
I think some of them are probably feeling that way this morning. Obama, just to get to the basic facts, still leads in overall delegates. But Clinton, she has narrowed the gap, though not by much, winning roughly 66 delegates yesterday to Obama's 57. There are 35 more delegates to be awarded, and as we know, every single one counts. Andrea Bernstein, our takeaway political director, you're in Pennsylvania. Big night for Clinton and her supporters. Was there a sigh of relief, a sigh of total expectation? What are they saying?
Well, that would be live radio, and sometimes we lose people, but we will get Andrea back. Mike Luo is with us. He's a New York Times political reporter. You know, one of the gauges, Mike, of this campaign is the money that has been raised, massive amounts of money by Barack Obama, and Senator Clinton was hurting for money until last night. This morning, the campaign claims they raised $2.5 million in less than 4 hours after last night's victory. How are you tracking the money on the Democratic side, and can the Republicans match it?
Well, I don't have any reason necessarily to doubt their claim. I mean, I talked to Peter Dow, their internet director, about 10:45 p.m. last night, and he had told me he was struggling to give me a accurate number that I could put in the newspaper because it kept spiking, it kept rising. It had started rising as soon as the networks called the race, which was around 9 o'clock, I think, and. And at that point, he was just saying, you can just go with well over $1 million, which is at like 10:45. And then the campaign put out around 11:30 that it was over $2.5 million, and I didn't necessarily doubt it. I mean, to put that in context for them, their best day ever, their best single 24 hours ever online was about $4 million. That came 2 days after the February 5th contest, when word of her loan, she loaned her campaign $5 million when they were having some cash problems at the end of January. And when that news broke, that sort of triggered this tidal wave of contributions.
Well, it certainly indicates that the campaign has maybe turned their cash position around in the very short term. I guess the other thing that it suggests is that there's money waiting on the sidelines at each one of these contests, and that it weighs in based on, you know, whether the race is called one way or the other. I mean, it seems a little unprecedented that the money is sort of waiting for each tick of the clock in the campaign.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's actually that it's not necessarily always tied to who wins or loses, actually. I mean, like the Obama campaigns, one of their biggest days ever was after New Hampshire when he lost. And so, yeah, the Clinton campaign is saying that 80% of this new money was 80% of this money that came in was new donors, and so it's not necessarily surprising. I mean, these fundraisers always joke, but these are a lot of times the high dollar fundraisers who depend on these wealthy donors. That whenever they're exhorting each other to go deeper, and their other fundraisers claim that they've tapped out their networks. They say that there are 300 million Americans, and a very small minority of them have contributed to political campaigns. So there's more to tap. But yeah, it would be very difficult for her. It'll be very interesting to see what the Obama campaign reports in the morning of what they raised online, because I guess up to this point, with the most recent accurate numbers we had were for the end of March, mm-hmm. They just had an FEC filing on that, and in that, Clinton showed that she had $10.3 million in debt.
Yeah, that was interesting. Right, hold on there for a second. I mean, the headlines all day today are going to be these campaign numbers. They're going to be super delicate pledge numbers. We've got Andrea Bernstein back. How do we gauge the headlines throughout the day today?
Well, I think that it is. I mean, it's interesting because the Hillary Clinton people want to move your eye away from the ball. They want you not to think about their numbers. I mean, by historical standards, Hillary Clinton has done amazingly well as a campaign fundraiser, but Barack Obama has done so much better. And I think that the example of that was that in the middle of her speech last night, which was one of her most thematically unified primary night speeches, she actually stopped to say, go to HillaryClinton.com and give me money, which is highly unusual for such a direct pitch. She was able to keep her campaign alive last night. If she'd won by 20 points, she would have upended it. If she'd won by 2 points, there would be a lot of questions about whether she should stay in. But she sat right in the middle of what's happened every primary night, which is that it seems like it's going to be over, and then it's not over, and we'll be talking about Indiana and North Carolina.
But Andrea, let's take a look at the big picture, at the macro pictures, because the numbers are still not in her favor. What are the Clinton people arguing is her path, her strategy to win the nomination?
Well, what they're arguing is, if you look at what happened last night, remember some of those counties that we were just talking about the other day that I had visited in northeastern Pennsylvania? Those counties, she won by 75%.
Now,
that is huge. Those are some of the biggest margins that she's pulled in this campaign.
And who were the voters there?
The voters are people making less than $50,000, economically distressed, white, really hard scrabble voters that lived in these towns that once made a lot of money from the factories and aren't really sure where the jobs of the future are going to come from. The reason Obama did so well is because he trounced her in Philadelphia by 30 points. He won 65 to 35, and that's a big population center. So that is what sort of evened out Pennsylvania. But she's going to be taking this map, and she's going to be arguing to superdelegates. And in many ways, they're in a more important constituency than the upcoming primary states. And she's going to be saying, look how I can put it away in these areas of the country where Democrats need to win. So this is going to be fodder for her to make that argument. In her speech last night, that's really who she was talking to, is the superdelegates saying, you know, I may get knocked down, but I'm not out.
Because ultimately, they are going to be the deciders of who gets the nomination. But I just wanted to note one thing quickly, which is Hillary Rodham Clinton got somewhere around 1.2 million votes, and Barack Obama got 1 million votes. So it was a separation of about 250,000 votes.
Well, that'll help close her popular vote margin, and that's another argument for her. For superdelegates, I mean, it was small. It was not a huge win, but on the other hand, he outspent her by a lot.
But he also started way behind her about a month ago. What was that? What was that spread then?
Yeah, you know, that's been an interesting phenomenon. I think truly great that he is every state, California, every state except for maybe New York and Illinois. He has started way behind. He's closed the gap, and it's been a question about whether he's going to have a small gap or overtake her. And the question that the Clinton campaign is raising is, why can't he put it away? Why can't he close the arguments? Why can't he be winning? He has all the money. He has everything in his favor. He has more delegates. The superdelegates are falling his way.
Mm-hmm.
The wind is in his sails. So given all of that, what the Clinton campaign is saying, if he really were the best candidate,
why can't he close the deal?
Yeah, if she learned to shoot in Scranton, she's still a pretty darn good shot. Mike Lujo, if it's about superdelegates, I gather you can't buy superdelegates with campaign money, right? So what's a candidate to do?
you hang around and hope something happens, which to a certain extent is what happened in Pennsylvania.
Well, speaking of hanging around and hoping something happens, I mean, the Republicans have really managed to, wait around and really see things fall their way in terms of the Democrats, you know, tearing each other apart. How does that figure into the GOP fundraising and just their general playbook going forward?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big windfall for John McCain, obviously. There has been actually some struggles on the Democratic side. I mean, if you were a Democratic strategist, you'd probably want somebody. McCain's getting a free ride at this point. You'd probably want somebody, maybe like an outside independent group, one of these 527s or these 501c4s that technically can't coordinate with campaigns to get out there and start hitting him, or maybe the Democratic National Committee in some kind of independent expenditure. But some of these outside groups that were expected to be big players on the liberal side have struggled to raise money.
They're stymied. I mean, the candidates have taken all the money. They're stymied until this gridlock is done. Mike Lua, thank you very much for joining us. Lots more to talk about with the campaign financing arithmetic. Andrea, also, thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, a question for everyone.
Our takeaway question today, so if this election just keeps limping on, tell us this. If you were Howard Dean, how would you get out of this mess? My take at thetakeaway.org or at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
He could scream. He could just scream.
Oh, Howard Dean
could just,
scream.
He could just stomp around and scream.
Can we give Howard Dean a break? How about that?
No, the Democrats aren't giving him a break. Why should we?
He's got a tough job ahead.
Yes.
Not an enviable position necessarily.
Thought he was just going to coast into retirement.
You can email us at talkback@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 800-543-2543.
543-2543.
There are other headlines today, and for them, we turn now to Femi. Okay, hey there, Femi.
Hello there. Good morning to you all. Well, leading the news, of course, this morning, Hillary Clinton took the keystone state in yesterday's primary. Senator Clinton and Barack Obama looked to Indiana and North Carolina for their next face-off. While his Democratic rivals were in Pennsylvania, Senator John McCain was in Ohio talking about the benefits of free trade.
I believe the overall result of NAFTA has been an increase in our economy, benefit to our country, and that debate needs to go on.
John McCain's talk comes on the heels of a summit on free trade in New Orleans attended by President Bush. Spencer Buckus, a key Republican lawmaker from Alabama, has introduced another housing rescue bill. It's an alternative to the $300 billion program from the Democrats. The bill expands a Bush administration program that gives some struggling homeowners with subprime loans help to refinance with government-backed mortgages instead. The meat and dairy industries are dropping their opposition to a total ban on the use of downer cattle in foods. Now, these are cows unable to stand by themselves and are often prone to infection. The change follows February's recall of £143 million of beef from a California slaughterhouse. And finally, the Screen Actors Guild has reached separate deals that will allow 90 independent movie productions to be completed, even if the actors have to go on strike.
Huh. That seems like a bit of a concession.
Yeah. Stand-ins, a lot of stand-ins, I guess.
Do you think?
Yeah, back of the head shots. You know, stuff like that.
You can never tell.
Yeah, it's easy. It's an intense negotiation.
But the negotiations that continue with Sam
and
the
stand-in for
Hollywood
George Clooney,
studios.
Actually.
I would have thought so. Yeah, right. You're looking gorgeous this morning.
Thank you. Well,
more
from
news
the back.
Later.
From the back.
From the back?
From the back.
Drop dead gorgeous.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, baby.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. Produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. As perhaps the rest of the world knows, maybe less than people here in the United States, the world does not stop while the U.S. chooses a president. And setting the agenda is actually more difficult for a lame duck president in the middle of a campaign. And try though he might, President Bush has been attempting to set the economic agenda here in this hemisphere and around the world with limited success. And we decided to invite two guests in to talk about the global agenda in the midst of a campaign. Joining us now is Eduardo Porter, who's a member of the New York Times editorial board. He joins us from New York. Good morning, Eduardo.
Hey, good morning.
Also with us is Cassandra Walden, who's chief of external communications for the United Nations Development Program. Cassandra, thank you for joining us this morning.
Pleasure to be with you.
Eduardo, you know, let's start with you. The president is attempting to set the agenda in the waning hours of his campaign on issues that normally would not appear to be so controversial. Let's talk about the Colombia Free Trade Agreement to begin with. The president, as recently as yesterday, was talking about this. How does the president set the agenda here? Why has it become so controversial? And what's the real stumbling block?
Well, I think President Bush sees this as an important part of his legacy, the Colombian FTA, and that's perhaps why he's been pushing so hard to get this deal, which to others might seem minor. Now, why it's become so controversial, first, I would perhaps disagree with the fact that these sorts of deals have not been controversial of late. In fact, free trade deals have been very, very controversial throughout the Bush administration and even before. I mean, just try to remember Clinton's battle to ratify NAFTA. It was
On the subject of NAFTA, I mean, NAFTA is all over this campaign. We've got both of the candidates talking about NAFTA. Take a listen to this, and we'll talk about it when you come back.
Canada is negotiating a Colombia free trade agreement. Mexico has a free trade agreement with Colombia. And a lot of folks are waiting for the United States Congress to bring this issue up and pass it.
That, of course, was the president talking about the Colombia free trade agreement. But as you know, Clinton and Barack Obama have been talking about NAFTA over and over again. It is controversial, but I guess, you know, my impression to what you just said is if Bush's legacy has slipped to a Colombia free trade agreement, that seems far down the ladder of importance for the kinds of things that presidents typically think of as their legacy, Mideast peace agreements, that sort of thing.
Well, indeed, I would agree with that observation. Nonetheless, he does think this to be a really big deal, and he's going down to the wire to get it passed.
And Eduardo, what do you think his chances are? I mean, I recall last month he was saying that he was going to push this proposal on a fast track, but he was stymied by Congress. Where does that stand now? He's still talking about it, but what can he really do about it?
Look, it's a tough one to call because we're in kind of uncharted territory. President submitted it to Congress. They signed it in a couple of years ago in 06. And they'd been trying to get a deal with Congress so they could submit it in more kind of like amicable terms to get it passed. When the administration wasn't able to do this, they decided to try to force the matter and submitted the deal against the will of Democrats in Congress, thinking that because of the rules that govern these sorts of things, Congress would have a certain period of time to say yay or nay to the pact, to the free trade agreement, and that many Democrats would at the end of the day vote yes. However, Nancy Pelosi pulled a tactic that the administration wasn't expecting, which was suspending the clock, which just leaves it frozen in limbo.
Right. I mean, no wiggle room for the Bush administration on this.
Right. That's exactly. Sure. Right now, yeah. It doesn't seem they can do anything directly. Right. However, from what Pelosi and other members of Congress, other Democrats in Congress have said, there does seem to be some room for negotiation. It seems Democrats are very interested in an expansion of the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, and they've been asking for this for a long time, and the White House hasn't been paying any attention.
Clearly
there would be room to negotiate this against the Colombian FTA. I am not sure that this will happen, but it perhaps could happen.
Yeah, well, if the campaign stops, you know, gets out of gridlock, perhaps the Democrats will have time to focus on something besides the campaign. Let's broaden this out a little bit, Cassandra. The Bush administration spent a lot of the first term talking about a potential legacy in places like Africa on AIDS and
poverty.
You know, is that a place where the Bush administration is attempting to, you know, carve out some kind of legacy in its waning months in 2008?
I think that's very true. I mean, you know, President Bush was recently in the region, and he was actually received like a rock star.
He was.
Because people perceive him to be someone who has made a major impact, particularly on HIV/AIDS, poverty, on democratic governance. You know, the U.S. has been a great supporter of countries which have made strides on elections, on transparency, on fighting corruption. So I think that Africans, by and large, see President Bush as a friend. They've seen a lot of progress over the last 8 years of him focusing on African issues. He's been to the region twice. That's a really important thing, and it's made a lot of news in the region.
You know, it argues for a constitutional change in the United States. We should have two presidents, the one that's running and then one that's the lame duck president who deals with, like, the important issue.
And I want to say something else, just going back to the trade issue. I mean, this is, he's really facing some trouble with NAFTA and with the Colombia trade agreement. But I will tell you that at the global scale, developing countries are very frustrated because their own trade talks across the globe with the rich countries are going very slowly. So this is not a problem that only President Bush is facing with his own particular agenda and legacy. It's something that is spilling over across the globe. And we see that with African countries trying to push the rich countries further into a more equitable
and
trade
especially given the global food crisis.
Well, we're going to talk about that.
Absolutely.
Is going to stay with us. Eduardo, very quickly before we go, do the Democrats have any chance of renegotiating NAFTA if they get into the White House? Is that actually going to happen?
I doubt it. It's not impossible, but I doubt it. It is a very, very big deal. The United States trades about worth $1 trillion with Canada and Mexico. And Canada and Mexico don't really want it reopened. If it were reopened, they'd probably have their own items on the agenda that they'd want to change.
And
so
endless discussions
I guess
there.
That it's too tough.
Right.
But hey.
Well, thanks, Eduardo. Thanks for joining us. Eduardo Porter is from the New York Times editorial board. He spoke with us from here in New York. And joining us from the Nerve Center here at The Takeaway, Femi Okeh.
Good morning. Now, if you went to bed early and woke up early, you may not have got this news. We've been tracking Hillary Clinton's win in yesterday's Pennsylvania primary. More on The Takeaway a little bit later. In international news, Zimbabwe's neighbors have blocked a shipment of Chinese freighter carrying arms. Countries in southern Africa have refused to dock the ship for concerns the weapons would be used against Robert Mugabe's opponents. With Sudan's census underway, UN officials say the conflict in Darfur is deteriorating. The full deployment of a new peacekeeping force has been delayed into 2009, and the UN says there's no prospect of a political settlement for a war that has killed an estimated 300,000 people in the last 5 years. Human rights groups are calling for the appointment of an independent special advisor to monitor continuing violence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Anne Van Woudenberg from Human Rights Watch told the BBC that the situation in Eastern Congo was dire. More news coming up later in the program.
Thank you, Femi.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Jeff Deck, there in Missoula, Montana. Jeff, how you doing?
Oh, pretty good. How about you?
Just fine. You've been on the road for 6 weeks, right?
I have.
Price of gas at the beginning of your trip was?
It was in the 310s in New England.
And today it's something like what?
It's in the high 340s in Missoula, Montana right now.
So Jeff Deck has been traveling across the country for the past 6 weeks on a project called the Typo Eradication Advancement League. That's actually to correct grammar across the U.S. And normally, we might want to talk about that with you, Jeff. But in the middle of this spiking energy crisis, we were actually more interested in your energy costs, because you would think that a traveling across the country grammar improvement project would actually be a pretty cheap thing to do, but not so in 2008, correct?
No, definitely not.
So your nice idea has become a crazy idea.
Well, it always was a crazy idea, but now it's crazier.
Where was the highest price of gas, and how does it make you change your calculation for how you get through the day? Because I suspect you're on a fairly limited budget.
Well, it was California, where the gas prices were ranged from the $3.80s to $4. I believe they have some sort of fuel surcharge added in there. It didn't really make me change the way I was going about this trip, though, because it's driving across America, and it's more efficient than taking the bus.
More efficient than taking the bus. And there's better grammar in your car than there is on the bus. Jeff Deck, thank you very much for joining us. And we'll check in with you again, both on energy prices and on how America's grammar is doing. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Lisa Marganelli, who's the author of Oil on the Brain, Adventures from Pump to Pipeline. Jeff Deck's adventure is a bit of a microcosm for all Americans, and really people all over the world, who are recalculating their monthly income on the basis of energy costs. Oil hit $120 a barrel yesterday, coupled with the weakening U.S. dollar. I mean, this is having impacts everywhere in economies all over the world. Lisa, where do you think this is going?
Oh, it's really hard to tell where this is going. You know, we used to describe globalization as a butterfly flaps its wings in China, and, you know, there's an earthquake in Paris, and this is just multiple butterflies. And
wait, it's multiple baseball bats.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is outrageous.
It's really nuts. And, you know, it's one of these things. The oil economy, oil made a fluid economy, and, this has been growing since perhaps 1900, this sort of global economy of oil. And a single tanker can change hands 300 times from the time it sets out from an oil port.
300 times?
300 times. Yeah, that's how fluid it is.
Let's talk quickly about this precise issue of, you know, in an environment where the financial sector is in trouble, stocks are a risky bet.
Mm-hmm.
Gold is down from its $1,000 an ounce record. People are looking to oil to hedge their wealth and are actually speculating in the oil markets, and that's part of what's driving these prices?
That's part of what's driving it. Part of the other thing is people like Jeff and like me, who have seen gas double in the past 5 years and haven't taken our foot off the gas. I mean, it's not like Jeff canceled his trip or he's carpooling all of a sudden.
Well, I mean, there's some things have to go on. Grammar improvement has to go on. We can't be sacrificing that.
Unnecessary apostrophes are despicable. The other thing that's happening is you know, drivers all over the world are watching GDP improve, and they're continuing to drive. People now, people buy more gas not because it's cheap, but because their own GDP or their own wealth is growing. You've got nationalism in the countries that have the oil. More and more, the oil reserves are concentrated in the hands of OPEC countries, and they're not investing more in bringing more oil to the surface. They're investing in other things.
Well, Lisa, the oil market is something that we need to continually check in with you on. We have to move on to a different segment here, but the idea that speculators are driving the price, that a single tanker can change hands 300 times. Not only are we talking about a changed oil market, an oil price market, but we're talking about oil really plugged into the entire global economy. Thank you very much for joining us. Lisa Marganelli is author of Oil on the Brain, Adventures from Pump to Pipeline. Adventures, yeah.
And the cost of oil is just aggravating an already truly troubled global food crisis that just seems to be getting bigger and wider every day.
Egyptian police fire tear gas to try to disperse crowds after 2 days of demonstrations. The anger here at low wages and rising food prices is such that people ignore laws against holding protests like this. Almost 200 have been arrested since Monday and scores injured.
That's the BBC's Jane Haddon reporting, and calls for actions are going louder as the food prices continue to skyrocketing, and they're triggering security concerns and fears of continued violence. And we're talking about prices for basic food things like rice and maize and wheat, and they just keep getting higher and higher. Now, food here in the United States is expensive, Cassandra, but it's far more disastrous, those rises in prices in places like Africa. And we are talking with Cassandra Walden, the chief of external communications at the UNDP. So what can be done? Who's calling for actions? It looks like, sounds like advocacy groups and governments are on the same page, are they?
I think today we can say that there's a real understanding that this is a problem which is affecting everyone, and that those who have the least capacity to cope need action now. You've heard a call for the Group of Eight Industrialized Nations to put this on their agenda when they get together in Japan later this year. You have the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, calling for an international conference on this issue, and people are really starting to step up to the plate and begin to discuss what can be done now to help improve the situation poor people are facing. And we're, you know, we in the United States, we go to buy our Triscuits, the prices are increased. We go to buy Snapple, the prices are increased. Maybe we have to cut back on the amount of times we go out every week, the number of times we go out every week for dinner.
And again, that ripples through the economy.
Exactly.
That's an employment question right there.
Exactly.
Let's talk about influence here. Does the UN have influence here? Indonesia last week took its rice crop off the market to preserve domestic tranquility. Yeah. That had ripples around the world.
Absolutely. I think we do have influence, but we recognize we are one partner among many, and we need to sit down at the table and really discuss this with governments and with experts. There are solutions out there, and there are some countries which are actually doing the right thing. I mean, Ethiopia, a country which we know has been famous for its famines and captured the hearts and minds of Americans 20 years ago through We Are the World, through many different efforts to raise money to help feed the Ethiopians. Today, they are opening their own markets to ensure that traders and farmers get together to take better advantage of the market.
But has the UN, as well as foundations and governments, been slow to react? Because it seems like this was a confluence of events that, i.e., oil prices are now more expensive, that you had distribution problems with getting food to the people who need it. So you put all those things together, and it just exacerbates a really troubled situation, and we just have a few more minutes.
It's very true that there is a confluence of events, and some of this could have been predicted. Today,
well, we'll talk about what could have been foreseen when we come back. You're going to stay around with us in the next segment. That's
Cassandra Walden, Chief of External Communications at the UNDP.
Food interlocked with energy all over the world.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji, produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We're following the results in Pennsylvania, where Senator Hillary Clinton beat rival Barack Obama. So there'll be lots to learn about that story and what happens next in the Democratic nomination process. Also, oil prices up. How are they affecting what's happening not only in our economy, but also in the world economy? And also, we're taking a look today at China. 19 years ago, John, as you said to me this morning, it would have been unimaginable that China would be hosting the Olympics.
Yeah, they were hosting another event 19 years ago.
The world, yeah, of course, was watching all kinds of pictures coming out of Tiananmen Square of bloody clashes between soldiers and students and workers wanting more freedoms. And I think feelings are still pretty raw from what was going on then. And
Certainly a big defining moment that everyone remembers somewhere or another if they were adults at that time. People forget that the Tiananmen Square massacre and the protests started very, very small. There were single character posters that were put on the Tiananmen Square wall that gathered students to talk about democracy. Then Hu Yaobang, who was a supposed reformer in the Deng Xiaoping government, was ousted. That became a protest, and it spiraled from there. Within weeks, the protests spread to others, and it became a historic event on June 4th.
Troops have been firing indiscriminately, but still, there are thousands of people on the streets who will not move back. After hours of shooting and facing a line of troops, the crowd is still here. They're shouting, "Stop the killing and down with the government."
And that was June 4th, as you just said, John, in Tiananmen Square.
That's my birthday.
And is it really?
Yeah, I always remember.
But by
that.
Dawn that day, the streets were silent there, and the uprising had been crushed. And it's impossible to know exactly how many people died or were injured. We tried looking that up and talking to some folks. And the bottom line is the Chinese government, of course, never released any official numbers. We've seen estimates ranging from 200 dead to 7,000 people
dead. Quite a disparity.
Huge.
Well, the morning after, a line of tanks rolled through the center of the square, and anyone who was there or anyone who watched the news on that week 19 years ago saw a young man appear from nowhere standing in the path of a line of tanks. Amy Wong witnessed the event from a hotel balcony.
The tank did not try to just run him over. It turned to go around him. And then the young man jumps in front of the tank. And then the tank turns the other way, and the young man jumps the other side. They did this a couple of times, and then the tank turned off its motor. And then it seemed to me that all the tanks turned off their motors.
Of course, if you weren't born in 1989, you have no knowledge of that. But if you were in China at any age in 1979, you have no knowledge of that. Those pictures are banned. It's actually a crime to possess them.
Is it really a crime?
Yeah.
And the legacy is still alive. There have been reports that Chinese officials are considering banning live television broadcasts from Tiananmen Square during the Beijing Olympics, fearful of more protests there after what we saw with the torch.
Yep.
People protesting.
Absolutely.
The Chinese relationship with Sudan and also the clashes with the monks.
More images at thetakeaway.org, including the Frontline documentary.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adori Udoji. Produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We have some big headlines for you. Femi Oke is here with them. What do you got?
Hello again. Top stories we're following today. President Bush says the economy is going through a slowdown, not a recession. And Senator Clinton savors her win in the Pennsylvania primary. And in sports news, Jake Long seemed at ease in his new role as the NFL's number one draft pick. The Miami Dolphins were also grinning. They signed the Michigan left tackle to a five-year, $30 million contract. The draft begins Saturday. The first round of NBA playoffs continued last night. The defending champion San Antonio Spurs came up huge in the second half against the Phoenix Suns, taking a 102-96 victory with plenty of help from Tony Parker. And the playoffs continue tonight with Philadelphia facing off against Detroit. NHL quarterback action finished up last night as the Philadelphia Flyers took their series against Washington with a 3-2 overtime win, and the San Jose Sharks marched over Calgary by a score of 5-3. Semifinals start tomorrow with Philadelphia moving on to Montreal and Colorado heading to Detroit. And on Friday, the New York Rangers will go to Pittsburgh for their matchup with the Penguins, and San Jose hosts Dallas. Before the end of this year hour, we'll be talking baseball with Henry Abbott from the True Hoop blog.
That's correct.
Baseball, I mean, and basketball, right?
Jake Long will not be in Miami next year at this time. Guaranteed. Bet you.
Any
amount of money.
I bet you $1.
$1.
Yeah, I'm cheap.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Look, it's not even legal. Our big story today, Pennsylvania. We've been talking about the primary results there where Hillary Clinton beat Barack Obama. But it's not the end of the road for the Democratic candidates. Now it's on to Indiana and North Carolina, which hold their primaries on May 6th. So it's going to be two primaries in one day. We've invited Micah Schweitzer, the news director at WNIN in Evansville, Indiana, and Mark Johnson, the political reporter at the Charlotte Observer, to give us a view from where they are sitting. And let's start with you, Micah, in Evansville, Indiana, where the polls have been basically a dead heat between Barack and Hillary.
That's right. It's 50-45 in the most recent poll. The margin of error is 4.2%, and so it's pretty close, too close to call, certainly. And it's obvious that both candidates are going to be very active in trying to win Indiana's May 6th primary. 72 delegates are at stake, and both candidates, Barack Obama, of course, was here last night and is campaigning some more today in Indiana, and Hillary Clinton is arriving later today for a campaign event in Indianapolis. So both candidates very active in Indiana right now.
You think there'll be any bounce for Hillary Clinton out of her win last night in Pennsylvania? What are some of the issues that the folks in Indiana are worried about?
Well, I've been thinking about that because jobs, like in Pennsylvania, jobs and the economy are ranking really high as the top issues here. Most of the ads that we're seeing from both campaigns are dealing with economic issues, and so so it's very likely that both candidates will be looking to try to appeal to blue collar voters and working class voters. They're both going to be trying to get the message out that they are the ones who can bring jobs back and keep jobs in the U.S. Like Pennsylvania, this is a manufacturing state, and a number of jobs have been lost. And so there are probably going to be a lot of people watching the outcome of Pennsylvania as they seek to determine what to do with their own.
Yeah, no question. And Mark Johnson, you're watching things in North Carolina where Barack Obama has been polling ahead of Hillary Clinton. I think I've seen polls anywhere from 5 points to 19 points ahead. But as we all know, sometimes polls just don't turn into any reality as voters go to the polls. What's your thought there?
Well, he definitely has a pretty solid lead here. And if you sort of average all the polls, and it could be, you know, as high as 15%. But both candidates are still going all out, and they're basically hitting the same issues that they're hitting in a lot of other states. And that's because, unlike say 10 years ago, North Carolina's economy and electorate is a lot more like the rest of the country. I mean, a few years ago, when candidates came in here, you know, they had to make the nod to the tobacco quota system, and then, you know, maybe toward
the tobacco quota system,
exactly, which no longer exists because we are the number one tobacco producing state, and that was something that the candidates had to talk about. They had to, you know, reassure the farmers they were going to support that program. Well, they don't mention that anymore, and they don't give the nods to the conservative side of certain issues because the electorate has changed.
But there's an interesting contrast between North Carolina and Indiana in the sense that Indiana is a more traditional manufacturing economy that's in some difficulty, whereas in North Carolina, you've got a large service economy, a sort of a high-tech economy there outside of Charlotte, plus a sizable African-American population. Seems to me to be Barack Obama country all the way around.
Right. We've transformed from, we used to be tobacco, textiles, and furniture. Well, all those things have gone away. And now it's banking, high-tech, pharmaceuticals, things like that, like I said, similar to the rest of the country. And as you point out, potentially as high as, 40% of the Democratic primary vote could be African-American.
Well,
40%,
40%,
huh?
Yeah, it's big. Hmm. Well, Mark Johnson, thank you very much. We'll check in with you next week as we get closer to the primary. Also, Micah Schweitzer joins us from Evansville, Indiana. We'll check with both of you guys next week. Thank you very much. Politics in North Carolina and Indiana.
40% African-American in North Carolina. I didn't know that.
Big.
That's the takeaway for
me
today.
That's the takeaway, yes. And again, another state that's like shocked to be decisive in the Democratic primary. Speaking of shocked to be decisive, the NBA playoffs are underway. And yes, it was another exciting game of watching the San Antonio Spurs last night.
6-point game. Diaw guarded by Ginobili in the three. Rebounded by Stoudemire. He hit one 3 moments ago. He tees up another, missing game. Parker's got it. Zeroes on the clock. And San Antonio has gone up 2-0.
Yes.
The defending champions have held
the few words that the NBA hates more than any other. San Antonio wins another game. Yes. I think NBA is counting on a bigger rivalry in the NBA playoffs, but the defending champs are certainly have to be considered the favorites, at least headed into the playoffs.
If they win, they deserve to be in the finals.
Of course they do. And joining us now,
they
deserve the absolutely. No, they're the defending
trophy.
Champs. I'm just trashing them because I'm sick of them. But Henry Abbott joins us from the True Hoop blog. Henry, tell us about some of the other big matchups in the NBA playoffs. I'm certainly loving the Lakers-Boston.
Yeah, well, that's what you and a bunch of NBA executives are holding their breath for that one. It's still the first round, though. Right now, I don't know if you caught any of New Orleans-Dallas last night, but it's like the coronation of Chris Paul right now, where he's an extremely young player, but he did almost everything he did with the ball last night was absolutely perfect and turned out so well. And the Mavericks are heavyweights, but they don't seem to be able to get even close to the Hornets right now. So that's exciting.
The Nuggets? How do you feel about the Nuggets?
They might win a game or two. I think the Lakers are heavily favored in that series.
Phoenix round.
San Antonio obviously supposed to be almost like a preview of the would be Western Conference Finals, but it hasn't really panned out that way.
We got Boston Atlanta.
Atlanta, no chance.
No chance. Yeah, I think it was something like a 20-point margin last night, or short of a 20-point margin.
The differential between by some fancy new stats, you can measure like how good a team is. It proves to have pretty good predictive value when you look at how much they won by on average all year long. The Celtics won by one of the biggest margins in NBA history on average, and Atlanta usually lost games. And so the discrepancy there is one of the biggest in any playoff series history, which means Boston are just massive favorites.
Well, that's a great digest of the NBA playoffs. And Henry, even the Knicks have something to be happy about this playoff season, right? You know what I'm talking about?
What do they have to be happy about?
Isaiah's gone, man.
Oh, right.
He's pretty much gone, right?
Pretty
He's
much.
Not entirely gone.
Isn't this a very odd setup? Donnie Walsh, who was one of his mentors, who gave him his first coaching job at the Indiana Pacers, comes into the Knicks and says, okay, Isaiah Thomas no longer going to be coaching the team, but he's going to be here advising me, though he can't have any contact with any of the team members.
Can't have contact with women, team members.
What's going on with that?
Well, there's been kind of a parlor game among NBA journalists of what is Isaiah's connection to James Dolan. Does he have some dirt on him? Or there's actually been some speculation, unfounded, that maybe Isaiah had some connection to upcoming free agents, and by having him around, they'd have inside track on some big name free agents. But
maybe Isaiah actually owns Madison Square Garden. We don't really know about that. Henry,
I think the thing is he
quickly.
Yeah, they haven't been able to settle on a buyout, and so in the meantime,
right,
they're willing to paying the rest of his money, so he's hanging around.
And Dolan's hates the press. So Henry Abbott, thank you very much, author of the True Hoop blog.
Thanks for having me.
Here's a takeaway response. Man, Dean shouldn't even be involved in this. I still question his sanity after that screaming episode. That's Franklin Dart in Evansville, Indiana. They're going to be voting there in Evansville. And our question today is, as this Democratic nomination process just limps forward, what should Howard Dean, the head of the DNC, do? How should he resolve this? We want to hear from you at mytake@thetakeaway.org or at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And I want to give the last word to Cassandra Walden, who's Chief of External Affairs here at the United Nations Development Program. I mean, this food story that we were talking about earlier, this is the story of our era, I think.
Absolutely.
Don't you believe?
Absolutely. It's impacting all of us.
And it's like nuclear proliferation.
Absolutely. We're calling it a silent tsunami because it's really sweeping the globe. It's impacting all of us, both in New York and in Southern Africa.
Cassandra, thanks for joining us. That's all for The Takeaway this hour. We'll see you online, takeaway.org.
Major funding for The Takeaway is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, with additional funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, the Skoll Foundation, the Henry Luce Foundation, the Freeman Foundation, and the Star Foundation. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.